Hi, everyone. My name is Anne-Julie Vallée. Welcome to Innove & Créa. Today, my guest is Rachel Dickus. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. I am so happy to be here.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to have you and very grateful that today we'll address a fascinating yet possibly difficult topic, which is trauma-informed and trauma-responsive design. Before we go any further, I really want to give a trigger warning to the listeners. We'll talk about trauma. Perhaps you've experienced it. Maybe you experience it right now. Maybe you don't know that you experience it, and maybe it'll trigger you. And I think it's important to be mindful if it does happen while you're listening to this episode. Just pause it. Please just come back to your body. Breathe, reach out to a friend that you trust or to a helpline. It's very, very important that you care for yourself. So yeah, do you have something to add to that trigger warning, Rachel?
I appreciate you offering that because I really do believe, and I have found through the practice and the study of trauma and trauma-informed design, trauma-responsive design, that sometimes talking about these topics at even a 30,000 foot, you know, purview can be activating for people, mm-hmm. or it can make you either feel triggered, activated, nervous, maybe even a little bit anxious, just because you may have been feeling similar things, but you may not have had the language to actually articulate like what that was or what that might be. So I appreciate the opportunity for people to ease in. And one of the other things that I often encourage is, these types of things like podcasts, books, articles that we read, we can always put them down and we can always come back to them. So that opportunity to hit pause is always there.
It's always there. And as always, whatever reference we'll talk about will be linked in the show notes. I think having done a lot of work around trauma healing for myself most of my life, it's interesting because you reach a moment where you so want to understand and it's so fascinating. And we know more about how this works now than ever before and how the brain is involved, how it's not your fault. But you sometimes, some of you might be in that process. And so you want to learn more, but it's also triggering. So, you know, take your time. Just respect your boundaries around curiosity as well. So that's all okay. So Rachel, you're a licensed clinical social worker. You're a designer, a researcher. You're a founder of Social Workers of Design. And you also work for the United States Digital Service. You do a lot of things. before we go any further, I'll ask you the root question. I ask that to every single one of my guests. And it's very simple. When you were, 10, 12 years old, what were you fascinated about, interested about, curious, passionate about?
The immediate thing that I can answer. So it's not even like, what's my gut feeling, for this response? I mean, it was absolutely all things outer space. So I very much so wanted to be an astronaut when I was that age. So that 10, 11, maybe I was growing out of that a bit when I was like 12, 13, but definitely 10, 11, even younger, just absolutely amazed by the stars and the moon and space travel, astronauts. All of it. I just could not soak up enough. I mean, I was just absolutely just always in wonder with it.
Oh, wow. So how does your life progress as a youngster interested in astrophysics and then becoming a social worker, which, to be honest, is not that different when you think about it? We're all little universes that need discovered.
Exactly. It's almost like the universe and the stars were were like a huge canvas or a huge playground. Yeah. And I think, you know, I think a lot of it, the connection that I could probably make at this point in my life was just a deep fascination and a deep curiosity about how things worked and, you know, how we all got here. And there's something about origin stories and things from like many, many years ago that I just was, I wanted to both know and explore and maybe in some ways like understand, but I have always definitely been much more interested in the pursuit of that curiosity and the jump or the leap, you know, over years into social work and sociology really, I think just evolved over time. And so, you know, when you think back on the ways that you and I probably grew up, it's almost like there was this conditioning of have maybe one interest, pursue one path in life, and that thing that you might have an interest in or that maybe you had an interest in but maybe wasn't as practical, just pick that one thing and then do that thing. And so I can look back and realize that there was quite a discouragement from being multi-passionate or having like more than one interest. And I think I just, I don't know. I never lost that curiosity with outer space and with the universe. And I'm very much like emotionally moved by those things. Yeah. I mean, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the Challenger explosion in 1986. I mean, I would have been in fifth grade at that time. And it was such a monumental, catastrophic loss. And it was also just the fascination within my grade school at the time and the excitement around the country to witness this and to watch this on a TV that was rolled out on a cart. And then everyone is collectively witnessing this really devastating thing. I would say with certainty, I know that had an impact on me in some way, shape, or form, even at such a young age. But I think the interest in social work and sociology has definitely been quite a lifelong, organic journey into just caring about the planet and caring about other people, and therefore finding these ways of like what are the pathways to do that? Like what are the different pathways to do that? So it's both uniquely different from like all things space, but also I think in some ways like eerily similar.
Yes, absolutely. Maybe some people wonder why I wanted to discuss this topic on the podcast. So podcast is Innov and Crea for innovation and creativity. And I'm an artist, I'm a designer. The reason why is, I find it super interesting, sure. But I was reading, and again, this is a link I'll provide. There's a pivotal book about trauma that is The Body Keeps the Score by Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. And right off the bat, I'm going to tell listeners that I had to put it down many, many times. It's a difficult read. It's fascinating, but it's difficult. Mm-hmm. And at some point in the book, he says trauma can hinder functions of innovation, creativity in the brain. And that's when I thought, we have to talk about this because we do not, generally speaking, know what trauma actually is and what it isn't. And how, when untreated, which sadly most people have experienced because it wasn't recognized and acknowledged, how deeply it can affect you as a person, affect your personality, affect your work, your love life, your general social life. So I thought, we need to think about it, especially as designers. We have to be mindful and understand all this before we create tools to help other people, which I think we're very much at the crossroads around that now. So let's start about what is trauma? I love the definition, the way you explain it.
Yeah, there are so many, you know, if for anyone out there, you know, you may have encountered a number of different definitions, and you could even like look up the word trauma and you'll probably get, you know, kind of like a smattering of different definitions. The definition of trauma that I often use and rely on, and that I've shaped it and have pulled from very like specific people who have studied trauma and study trauma and understand trauma in different ways. So there's this combination of like three different people. So Resma Menakem, who is also a social worker, Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, but then also like Dr. Bruce Perry, who also specifically talks about a lot of different aspects of trauma. But I love how he illustrates like the context in which trauma may have been experienced. And then there's a somatic practitioner, Corrine Bell, who I believe really is the first person who talked about trauma as something being something that's too much, too fast, or too long. Like it really is attributed to her. So other people have said it and have repeated it, but
and it's such a short reminder to evaluate, is this trauma?
Yeah.
Can you please repeat it?
Yeah. So there are these three parts. So the first part, which I often attribute to Corrine Bell, and it's trauma is something that happens that it's too much, it's too fast, or occurs for too long, and or for too long, I should really say. So it's not like an either or, it's like, yeah, it could be a combination of all those things. The second part is the part that I feel that I've heard Resma say many, many times, and I've heard other people like kind of repeat what Resma Menakem has said. And that is, it's talking about like the effect. And so he often says that, trauma can feel like some kind of like a sensation. You know, it's something that does not happen just in our brain. It happens in our body. Our brain is part of our body. The brain is the body. And he says that it could be some kind of a sensation, and that could be feel like tension, or that could be like a lack of sensation, like numbness. So again, like there's a spectrum and a continuum of how it may manifest in individuals. And then the third part, which is the part that I feel like is so often left out and doesn't get as much either airtime or just attention or even like unpacking and explanation, is the part that I now really attribute very much to Dr. Bruce Perry, because he talks about this beautifully in the book that he co-wrote with Oprah Winfrey. Mm-hmm. It's the book, What Happened to You? And he talks about context. And so the last part that I often say of this definition is that like context is essential. So what may be something that impacts me may not impact someone else.
Yes.
And we may be part of like a similar experience, but our proximity to that experience or our like relationship to that experience like might be very, very different. And it's also like, who was there? Like, so not just a person, but it could be a community. It could be members of your family. It could be friends, members of a chosen family. Who was there to support you when something occurred or as something is occurring?
Sorry, this part to me is massive.
Yeah.
How much trauma do we experience alone?
Yeah.
Not so much when it happens, but for which we won't have any support because of taboos, because of resources, because lack of resources or... And thank you for talking about that part too. I think it's vital.
Yeah, it really is. And it's another way to talk about, having lack of protection or a lack of support, which again, that's something that Resma talks about quite a bit, is also, I think another way of just distilling that is, when do we acknowledge other people for the experiences or the things that they are either going through, have gone through, and or may in the future have to go through, because there are certain experiences that are in life, that there are certain elements of experiences that are very much universal. We will all go through certain things.
Yeah.
And I feel like that there is a lot of power in just acknowledging that in other people. Again, like you don't need to be deeply empathic. You don't need to walk in someone else's shoes. It's literally just like seeing someone and seeing them for what they may have gone through. I have found, both in like a personal sense, but also in like in a professional sense over the years, that is about 60-70% of part of people's recovery is like that knowing that they have been acknowledged and knowing that someone sees them for what has occurred.
I love that. I think it's interesting. I can't remember if it's Dr. Bessel van der Kolk or Gabor Maté, but I remember one of the experts saying there are big T's and there are small T's. I think it's Dr. Van der Kolk. Often we hear we might all experience trauma, but not all will be traumatized.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? And it's like you're saying, there's context. There's personal makeup, family heritage. There's so many reasons why someone might be traumatized. It can be a big T, a big trauma, a car accident, war, or a rape, or abuse, bullying. But there might be a series of little T's, which combined. And that's why I love the definition in duration over time. Mm-hmm. If it never stops, it will create a trauma that will impact your functions, your brain functions, right?
Yeah. And then also, I mean, you're making me think of also the complexity of just humans and of just life in general, and the multiple experiences that people may have in their lifetime, the compounding effect that multiple experiences. So whether they're things that you may have had like no or little control over, yeah. You know, something which most traumatic experiences, we have little to no control over them. Like we can't turn it down a little bit. Yeah. I don't believe that these are things that people like willingly and wantingly choose to have occur. But if you think about things like a natural disaster, for example, you know, so let's say you're in a certain part of the world and you're just you live in a certain part of the world in a certain country that is like more predisposed to experience natural disasters, but you also are of a lower economic status, and maybe you have other complications, and maybe you have other things that have occurred and that have happened in your life. There's a compounding effect of all of the things that make up our life and our livelihoods and our lifelong experiences. And not to say that we are unable to build resilience and recover from different things, you know, like that's a whole other component, but there's a level of it of adversity that is significantly more difficult for some people on this planet as opposed to others. Mm-hmm. And I think just even acknowledging that component and that piece, again, it ties in that element of that context. So context can be situational, it can be geographical, it could be, you know, any number of things.
Yeah. I took out some pieces or information about trauma just so people can perhaps research more about it. So trauma can be physical. We're talking about injuries, exposure to chemicals, bacteria. It can be psychological, such as extreme stress or abuse. It can be emotional through loss. And it might take you to being always in a high alert state. This is when it's going to, over time, really impact you. But I like to say that because trauma is multifaceted. It's not just one thing. And I think we've been kind of trained to recognize it just as one massive thing. It can be a bunch of incidents that combined will create a bigger trauma. And there's also forms of trauma. Developmental trauma can be neglect, can be witnessing violence, abuse is part of that. Adult onset trauma, so violence, accidents, or combat for veterans, can be racial trauma. And I think it's important to, or gender trauma as well. Let's just, you know, put it out there. Discrimination, microaggression, racism, transphobia might create trauma. And so we more and more live in a complex world. And as part of that, we are more inclined to meet trauma ourselves or meet people who have been traumatized. That brings me to talk about what is trauma-informed and trauma-responsive design. What is it? What are these practices? And why are they important?
So this is such a big and such an important question. You know, I have done this myself, and I've been trying to not do this as much over the past couple of years. But sometimes the phrases trauma informed and trauma responsive are used interchangeably. And you know, maybe in the grand scheme of things, they're in the same like ballpark. But I do think that they're uniquely different in how they are practiced in the work that we do. So doing anything with a trauma-informed or a trauma-informed care like mindset is really foundationally is taking into consideration that people and communities have possibly, or maybe sometimes we do know this exclusively, but there's the possibility of the prevalence of that having occurred. And so how might we approach individuals in a different way if we had that mindset and had that understanding? So we don't necessarily need to know like all the specifics or even all the details of that. But this phrasing of trauma-informed care, it often is thought of as a brand new idea or something that's only within the past decade. It has been something that has been in conversation in different contexts, in different cultures around the world for many, many years, for literally centuries. But this, you know, kind of common, I'd say more common, more dominant, more mainstream, like understanding of trauma definitely comes from a lot of the work from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration within the U.S. And there are similar outfits of this, like around many, many parts of the world. But there was significant research and resources that were put into, like, how can we better understand and how can we better support really like children and youth. That is the primary origin. And then just also the evolution of big conflicts that were happening around the world. So post-Vietnam era, there was a different understanding just through the evolution of knowledge and the study of science and neuroscience and neurobiology, in that we knew that there were other things that were affecting people in different ways. And so like the deepening of that knowledge and the deepening of that science and that research was really happening in this way that was coinciding with also trying to build this stronger understanding of what is trauma. And is trauma, you know, up until I'd say within, you know, the past 100 years, like trauma was always thought of, or traumatic experience was thought of, something that was of a physical nature, not of something that was like maybe like psychological or emotional. It's a very, very, like, in the grand scheme of like the state of the world, like very much like a recent understanding or even a recent acknowledgement. The other component around trauma responsive practices or trauma responsive design, the way that I define that and the way that I try to embody that mindset in practice is that I've taken this knowledge of trauma and I've taken this opportunity to be both sensitive and aware to the possibility of trauma and traumatic experiences, that I am informed about how this might manifest in people and in communities and organizations. And then I do something with that knowledge. I don't just have all of this things that I've learned and sit and make a decision to maybe do something or maybe to not do something. I feel that embedding and integrating a trauma responsive practice is actually taking what you have learned and adding an action component to it. So doing something with that. So what does that look like? You know, for me, that might look like, you know, as someone who is both a practicing like design researcher and social worker, that might look a little bit different for someone like me. You know, I'm much more comfortable with connecting individuals or communities with resources, or helping them build those resources, or empower them in a way that can be ongoing and sustainable. But I have found that it truly is a very deliberate and intentional practice to change how we have been taught to practice design and design research. You know, there are so many different ways that people can practice like design and design research. But I have found over time, there's a lot of default mode that we get into. And that default mode is not, I believe it isn't always healthy. It isn't always ethical. It isn't always responsible. And in some ways, it can be quite harmful. And it can be also, I would say, also quite reckless. And so this ball of wax that I feel like I've been trying to, like, you know, detangle and make sense of for a number of years at this point, really started with me with wondering why designers were working on very similar issues like that I was working on as a social worker, but from a very different perspective, and obviously a very different discipline, and why I had ethical requirements and designers didn't. And why, if, you know, if I'm interacting and basically doing a different form of like design research, like as a social worker, like where is the level of responsibility? Where is the opportunity for care? And not just like care for the other people, you know, for the people that were maybe including this process or participants, but also care for the designer, because, you know, a care practice is really can look like a number of different things in social work practice. So I started really having these wonderings of like, where are all of these things in design, and what might that look like, or how could we practice differently if design is so proud of pulling from so many different disciplines, like, why are we not pulling from certain disciplines that would actually like bolster our credibility in a way that truly makes us like ethical and responsible, not just thoughtful and empathic in what we do?
Can you give us an example of practices and design that don't line up with requirements in, let's say, in social work that could be changed to become more ethical, more responsible?
Yeah. So one that I don't think it was obvious to me in the earlier years, but it was starting to become more and more obvious to me, like as the years went on of me being a social worker. So at this point, you know, it's 2023. When we're recording this, and I've been a social worker for 13 years. And before that, I had a whole robust career, like working in the nonprofit or social justice and social impact sector for about a decade. So one of the pieces that I've noticed, this is a bit more like generally speaking, but I have seen this in almost every design context or design engagement that I've been part of over the past several years. There is not always a clear-cut manager or supervisor or leader that designers can go to. Like within an organizational context, you might have like a hierarchy of leadership and someone who might be like your official supervisor who might like do an annual evaluation or might check in on you from time to time. The piece that is uniquely different about a social work practice, and this is true for a lot of other like clinical disciplines as well, is that there is this practice that is embedded into social work called supervision. And supervision is not typically someone who is your supervisor, you know? So it isn't like a friend and colleague, Kay McKercher, who's a designer in Australia.
Yes.
Like, we'll talk about how, like, supervision is not line management, you know? So the act of a supervision or supervisory process in social work is someone who is a peer. And typically they are more senior to you, like they have more experience. They might have their clinical license. They may have been doing the work for like many more years than you, but you meet with them on a regular basis. And for me, in the state of Illinois, in the US where I am, the requirement for clinical supervision was that I needed to, for every 40 hours that I worked, I needed to meet with someone who already had their clinical license and already had more experience, and I had to meet with that person for 1 hour every single week.
Wow.
And so over time, I had to build up 3,000 like work hours. So, you know, you can imagine like many, many weeks, like you're meeting with someone. For most people, it's like on average, like about 2 years. And so I'm still working and I'm doing my thing. I'm getting paid. I'm fairly, you know, autonomous. I have a direct supervisor. I have someone who like, you know, meets with me in a different context. But this person who did my clinical supervision or who I did my clinical supervision with is someone who I could talk about anything. So I could talk about a difficult case. I could talk about a certain kind of like complex situation and just really debrief and process like, you know, what am I seeing here? And did I handle this in a way that was the best thing that I could have done in that moment? So there's this like built-in component of really like debriefing and processing on a weekly basis.
Yeah, designers don't really have that. They have the line production bit, you know, how many hours, when are you going to take another case, wah-wah. But yes, that's very true. Particularly that we, as designers, if we work on human-centered design and we take into account the experience of others and, what do you do with that experience? What do you do if you encounter one of your participants who is overwhelmed, who's being triggered by what you're talking about, by the project, for whatever reasons? What do you do with that? It might trigger you and you had no idea there was a trigger there for you as a designer.
Yeah. I mean, I think about so much of the work that designers, design researchers do is often, not all of it, but I would say a good majority of it is in this sensitive and serious and often very complex, you know, situations and matters of concern that we're navigating. And so you can imagine that just part of being human is that at times we may be affected by the things that we hear, the things that we do. I think there's also, I mean, there's a deep element of power in design too.
Yeah.
You know, I often hear designers talking about how like they feel like you know, we're still as this collective discipline advocating for a seat at the table or advocating for our existence or, you know, trying to like make the case that we are valuable and that we're worthy. You know, these are all things that are just very deeply like social work concepts that we would be unpacking in a wide variety of different contexts. But I think that when there's this, when there is work that we're doing and when you're in an actual, let's just say like a design research encounter. So typically it's an interview and you're asking questions in a certain kind of a way. I feel like when we are not adding on, because it's not meant to be an additive, it's meant to be like deeply integrated. If we are integrating practices that are aligned with being trauma-informed and trauma-responsive, we are pausing to reflect on, is this a question that I need to ask or is this a question that I want to ask? Is this a question, like how I have it phrased right now, is this going to elicit a certain type of emotional response? And am I able to actually like handle that emotional response?
Yes.
And if I'm not, who holds me accountable to making sure that that other person engaged in this encounter feels safe or feels safer? Like who takes care of that experience, you know? Because in social work, there are explicit expectations of making sure that we are doing no harm, that we are mitigating harm, and also that social workers are, you know, for better or for worse, there's a little bit of conditioning with navigating that discomfort. And I would say learning how to be with harm. Mm-hmm. Designers are not taught that. Like by and large, they are not taught that.
Nope.
Now, there are some exceptions where there are some programs that are starting to much more explicitly talk about ethics and what does it mean to be an ethical designer? What does it mean to be a responsible designer? How do we design in a way that can be like innovative and you know, ethical and responsible? But still these elements of trauma feel, it makes people uneasy.
Although it's a hot potato.
It is a hot potato, although it's ever, ever present, you know, because there is not a single designer I have met with, either as an individual or as part of a team in the past several years, who has not admitted some type of moment or multiple moments of distress as part of the work that they do. So either the way that we do our work as designers, so the process, the timing, the pacing, and or the types of things that we are exposed to, and that we may not always be prepared for that exposure. And so that's where I have this deep, deep concern of not just, it's not a like wagging my finger at designers. It's more of a, what can we do to be more responsible, more ethical, more caring, and, you know, how can we be trauma responsive as part of that process? How can we learn some of these skills, build up a true trauma literacy, navigate these situations as they occur, and have a deep community of practice that helps us to debrief and process and be responsible and to be thoughtful in how we do this work? Like if there's any like kind of gold star to be looking towards, like that's what I feel like we could be working towards and aspiring. The other element is just, you know, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this. A lot of social workers want to like work their way out of a job. Like we don't want to be social workers. We wish there weren't so many like social ills and things that we're navigating. And I find that to be pretty true for a lot of designers too. It's like, wow, like they're excited over the opportunity to get to maybe problem solve or to make a like structural or systematic, like oppressive system, maybe less oppressive. But at the end of the day, we don't want there to be oppression to have to like design around or like design out of, you know? I think we typically like wish we didn't have to design for these types of things. So it just like keeps making this full circle in my head of, if we're going to be part of these things, if we are going to like collectively try to improve conditions on this planet, then can we do that differently? Can we do that in a way that is not, you know, manufacturing and contributing and being complicit to trauma and being complicit to harmful ways of practicing? And I believe that we can.
This episode will be very interesting for all the designers I know that listen to it, because I think some are just not aware that even from best intentions, that you might actually have a negative impact. You might even re-traumatize someone. And I love how you say, well, in design, we talk a lot about compassion. We talk a lot about empathy. For you, you say that compassion is empathy plus action. I love that. what examples do you have of how might we, you know, create design practices that are more ethical, more responsible, and still be, you're still doing innovation, but with this mindset of being ethical and responsible?
Well, one thing that's coming to mind is anytime I hear the word compassion, it's really hard to not also think about compassionate inquiry, which is, you know, which is foundational to everything that Gabor Mate works on and talks about. I mean, he has full multi-month curricula on just that thing. Like, how do you build that skill as a practitioner? So you could be a clinical practitioner, you could be like a healing practitioner. You know, there are other practitioners that can be part of that work and learn that. I can recognize and I want to acknowledge that this can feel very much like a slippery slope or very tricky territory if you are someone who does not have that expectation or that responsibility of someone like me who also has a clinical license. Like, there are certain things that I'm responsible for, I'm accountable for, and I am expected to do if I am to wear that hat as a social worker.
You're equipped now for it too.
Yeah. And just like how we were talking about at the beginning, like the different elements of the definition of trauma, the context in which someone might be working may shift or change over time, you know? So like the type of context that I work in primarily right now is very much a very design-centric context. Before that, it was a higher ed context. Before that, it was a hospital. Before that, it was a nonprofit context, you know? And so what you might actually do, like specifically, it might have a different shape and size and color depending on where you are. And so I wanted to just add that caveat because I, you know, I'm not advocating that everyone become a social worker, although there are designers who do decide to get that additional education and get that additional practice because they want to combine the two as well, which I think is just fascinating.
And be aligned, I guess, with those expectations and the capacity of supporting people, because I think, and I repeat that often and even on the podcast, but I have an issue with designers who are asking their clients, collaborators to dive into hot water or, you know, when themselves have never done work on their own inherited trauma, their own trauma that might have they forgotten about or denied. Sometimes I'm being told, yeah, but we're not shrinks. True. But then how can you possibly ask someone to dare and adopt change and jump in if you've never questioned that, if you never dared that yourself as a designer? And so there is this gap of awareness, support for yourself as a practitioner. Few people don't carry trauma, if we're being honest, whatever type, level, or intensity. But I think it needs to be included in the teachings now. We should talk about trauma in college anyway, so people can take care of themselves and own it. And so that should be the same for design practices, I think.
Yeah. I mean, you're making me think of an earlier question, and I feel like this larger narrative around design and designers and design research is to problem solve, but don't get too involved. You know, don't have a flat affect. You know, go in for the juiciest parts of the story, and we're going to use that. We're going to use those insights to then like do this thing, whatever that thing is. And, you know, maybe the instruction, if you will, is not that crude, but I do feel like that's the message that most designers have definitely gotten.
I think it's the underlined expectation, and it goes back to being a professional. If you're a professional, and I'm putting quotes, people don't see me, but, you know, then you're cut off from your emotions somehow. And I think that's how we've been trained. This is how the world has been working, that if you are emotional, then there's a weakness if you show emotions. Mm-hmm. We still struggle with this. Mm-hmm. While I think what the upcoming practices, such as yours, are showing is there can be some sort of Venn diagram and you still remain being professional. And yet your human part of you as a being with experiential knowledge can connect with the person you're interacting with, even on a professional level. And this is not being taught. To me, is the missing part in design.
Yeah, I think there's this you know, hidden expectation to be compassionate and to be able to turn these more emotional and relational components, to turn them on, but then turn them off as soon as you're done. And, you know, if there's something that is problematic, then you must have done something different or you must have done something wrong. Because then that seems to fuel this element of be relational, be in relationship with others as you're doing this process, but then turn right back to being transactional.
Switch it off. And
switch it off.
I love that. And transactional, yeah.
There are many reasons why I feel that that is a disservice, you know, just on a humanity-centered level. That's not how I want to show up in the world.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that we are acting without boundaries, because I think that's a whole other conversation that we could have. I think that if it's, if we are expected to be, you know, to be almost like robotic, to produce a thing, whatever the thing is, and to not acknowledge that we have a high likelihood of being impacted by both the way that we work and the work that we do, what we are exposed to, then again, like that fuels this element that feels not only unethical and not only irresponsible, but feels reckless to me.
Yeah.
Because it's being dismissive of what other people as part of this process may need. And it's drawing on this assumption that I'm designing for someone else and I'm not that someone else.
It's massive. What you're saying here is crucial.
There's this element of something that, you know, I did this pretty extensive training with Bessel van der Kolk a couple of years ago or a few years ago at this point. And there was this part of it where he was telling this very long story. I mean, it was like, it felt like a 45-minute like story that he was telling. And you could have heard a pin drop in this training. I mean, like everyone was hanging on with bated breath. And he was talking about the role of the practitioner, the role of the clinician when you're in this like, you know, client clinician like relationship. And like, what is the role that we have? And he said, for so long, we have had this relationship and this expectation, this understanding that, you know, we are not the people that we are helping, you know, like, and so in design, what would that parallel be? Like, we aren't the people that we are designing for by any means, like we are not them. And then he goes on, you know, he tells, like, he just uncovers every single detail of this. And then he says with such power, he said, it is not us versus them. He said, we are them.
Yes.
And no one said anything in the chat. It's like people were really struck by the power of realizing that experiences that we might witness may be experiences that we may have at some point, and or that loved ones that we have in our circles or in our networks, in our organizations, our colleagues, our peers, that they maybe have had those experiences as well. We may know that, we may not know that. And I think that there's an element within that I think is really, really powerful if we carry that with us as we are practicing design. So if we come into this work with an assumption that maybe, just maybe, the person I am talking with, the people I am talking with, hopefully the people that we are designing with, not designing at or for, that the people that we are actually in community with, that just maybe they have experienced something that is pretty significant and may have had an impact on them at some point in their life. What does that do to your mindset and how you might practice design?
Yeah.
You know, and again, if you to kind of come in with this, you know, it's not us versus them, like we are them mentality, I think that significantly changes like how you do your work and how you might want to do your work. I'll never forget something that a designer said to me. There are two different things. There was one designer who was probably around the same age as me, and someone who was more junior, like, you know, brought me in to just chat with their team. And the person who was younger said that, I feel like these things are really important. We should be learning about these things. Why are we not practicing this way? And the person who had, you know, significant experience, probably had like at that point, like 20, 25 plus years of experience. She looked at me like right in the screen, because this is over Zoom. And she said, I've never thought about this before. And I could tell by the way that she was sort of like looking off camera a little bit. She was like going through this catalog of all of her experience. And then she said, like, I don't think I've realized how much of my own trauma has actually maybe influenced how I've been designing all this time. It's almost like there is this deep, deep realization, but there was also like a bit of a weight that was lifted off of her by just being able to have a little bit of that language and that trauma literacy that I talk about to be able to piece some of those parts together. Again, like, you know, yes, have boundaries with your work. Absolutely. That is like completely critical. That is essential. But also like understand who you are and why you are doing the work that you're doing. Because there's a reason why I'm a social worker. Yeah. There's a reason why I care about design and design research. You know, it's not just like, oh, I woke up and I wanted to do it one day. You know, I mean, I wish it were that simple for all of us.
Yeah, if only. Thank you for talking about it. I think it's just so precious, so important. And I'm thinking, because I can hear some of my colleagues or friends listening to this and going like, I didn't study design to be a shrink. A solution to bridge perhaps and make steps towards a more ethical and responsible design practice might be in just teaming up.
Yeah.
There is power in the number of experience around the table. We all know that if we do human-centered design, but that includes designers. And mm-hmm. So, you know, why not try to bridge the missing bits, the gaps in experiential knowledge in teaming up with someone who's very different from you?
Yeah. I mean, I'm hearing two things that are themes in what you were just saying. Like one is like the power of true multi and transdisciplinary team. It's one thing to have, you know, an engineer, someone who is like a product designer, someone who is a design researcher, maybe someone who is like a data scientist, people who have these like unique skill sets and these like maybe these like more defined roles coming together. You know, so that's one element. Another is some of my favorite projects have been when I'm with a bunch of other designers who also have these additional like levels of experience and curiosities and these deeper things that they really, really like have been practicing and trying mm-hmm. to hone and refine. And they're bringing that as part of like the practice. And, you know, so that could look like individuals who have maybe a much deeper knowledge around like anti-racism, or people who have really deep practice experience around accessibility and inclusivity, you know, practices and design. Others who might have really strong capacities when it comes to like content and plain language, you know? So I love working with these other designers because there's a reliance and interconnectedness, of course, like as part of a team and an effort, but there's a constant learning with and learning from one another. And that is where I feel like we're pushing our practices, we're stretching them in these different directions, and they're maybe deepening in ways that we probably could not have anticipated and may not have even expected. You know, like there are so many things where I can say like, oh, you know, there are some things that I've done and there are some things that I've learned. And then I don't know if you experience this, but like as I get older, I realize like, wow, I have learned a lot and I have done like a lot of different things, but I have a lot to learn.
Yeah.
I have a lot more to learn. And like I started really feeling that in my late 20s, and it got a little stronger when I became a social worker and I realized like, huh, like there's a lot that I did not know before I became a social worker. And boy, did I think I thought I knew everything, you know? And so like, how can you like practice in this way that allows you to have confidence in what you're doing, but also like a humility that is like
yes.
deeply aligned with that? I really try to go into experiences with like, okay, there are some things that I know, there's a lot that I don't love, that I don't know, and there are things that I will most certainly learn.
And I'm willing
doing this.
I'm willing to get that in. And with humility say, well, look at that. I did not know that. And there's also an element of, you know, the world changes. So there is knowledge we didn't know 20 years ago. And so the idea of remaining open, and then you know, the next generation is going to come, it's going to bring something the way we did. You need to remain flexible and open. I think that's very, very important. There's an article on Medium that you wrote in 2021. And again, I will link all resources that we've talked about. I think it was in response to George A's Surviving Ideals article, which is a read. And you were quoting Peter Levine, who was saying, trauma is perhaps the most avoided, ignored, belittled, denied, untreated, and misunderstood cause of suffering. Very powerful.
It is very powerful.
Very powerful. Knowing all that, what's your hopes and dreams for your practice?
That's such a good question. And I love that quote. It is.
That's it. It's all in there, right?
It really is. It's like we should just end.
Why
now
is it important to talk about this? There it is.
I mean, it really is. I think, you know, kind of playing off of that quote, because I've revisited that quote a number of times as I've either been curious about a different element or another element and how it might intersect and what might that look like in terms of trauma and trauma-informed practices. So something that I have been thinking about quite a bit, as I'm sure you have as well, is definitely this element of grief as part of like trauma work. And what does that look like? Where is that similar? Where is it uniquely different? How does one maybe influence another? How can one really inform the other? So that's been a big component. Something that I had wondered about before this year, but definitely have been like a bit more like acutely tuned in like this past year. I think another thing that I came across, and I can share this article with you. It's not one that I wrote, that. but it was something that I was thinking about. Like, there's got to be someone that has surely thought about this thing and has written about this thing. And you know, I've got a friend like Vivian Castillo who talks quite a bit about like shame and like the power of shame and how designers really need to understand shame. And you know, and I fully agree with that. Like, I've never like disagreed with that sentiment or the things that she has shared. But it wasn't until I was like thinking about it in a different context. So not so much, so somewhat in the context of like the work that we do as designers and design researchers, but like, what are the other elements of where that might come up? And where are we maybe as designers experiencing shame, but we're calling it something else?
Yeah.
And so again, it has this like parallel to maybe we don't necessarily understand trauma or we don't think that we need to be trauma informed, but it's kind of like swirling around us at all times.
The language again, having a language.
The language.
Comes back to that. Yeah.
It's the power of that. You know, like the language really, really matters. Like having these words to be able to articulate these sentiments and these things that we feel, you know, somatically is just so critical. And so I was just doing some like basic, you know, searching a handful of weeks ago, and I came across this fantastic article within the past few years that talks about how we need to have a shame sensitivity when we are doing or thinking about integrating any kind of a trauma-informed approach. And the way that they broke it down, it's just like, I don't know if this article would have resonated as much, maybe even like a decade ago or even before the pandemic. You know, there's something about, or I'll say pre-pandemic, because I feel like the pandemic is very much ongoing for a number of people.
Yeah.
But there's something about the way that they broke down, like how that shows up and what does it look like when we are not sensitive to this and where are we potentially like missing the mark? Again, it's like it confirmed this. Okay, there's this way that we could do relational trauma-informed practices or trauma-responsive practices, and there's a way we could do transactional trauma-informed practices. You know, for me, it's like, I don't want to pick and choose when I decide to be trauma-informed. I want to be trauma-informed and I want to practice in a trauma-responsive way at all times.
Yeah.
That's how I want to be a parent. That's how I want to be a spouse. That's how I want to be a citizen of the world. That's how I want to practice design. What would this look like if we thought about it differently? And it's not, and I don't pick apart every single thing. Like sometimes like people will say like, hey, Rachel, can you look at this interview guide and like maybe give us some feedback? And sometimes I have no feedback.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, you naturally have, you're doing the thing. I don't even know what you need from me. If anything you need from me is like confirmation and validation.
Yeah.
And acknowledgement, the power of acknowledgement again.
Yeah.
You know, is this like acknowledgement that people like do have these skills like intrinsically. Those two things I feel like are big components, especially as we are thinking about the human condition, the span of life, the continuum of so many different kinds of things that can and will happen to all of us. And then I think people will be emerging out of the pandemic and this experience over the past few years, the acuteness of the experience for many, many years to come. Some people will be recovering and trying to recover from it for the rest of their lives because Absolutely. Of
it has again, been traumatic for a lot of people. And yes. we need to acknowledge that. Not just yes. I have long COVID, therefore it's difficult. The isolation has been difficult. The change yes. of like losing the job, losing
rituals. Yeah. You know?
Losing yep. rituals. My God, yes. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes. Yeah. What would you say to the listeners? Some are designers. Some listen to them like, oh, wow, that's interesting. I don't know where to start to bring it into my practice and maybe bring some awareness to my own experience, how it might tint your interactions, your work.
Something that's coming to mind. So this is something that, you know, of course, I learned through like my own experience of going through higher ed and then going back to work in higher ed. It's just this, the notion of explicit and implicit learning, you know, so like there are explicit ways that we can learn about trauma. So you could like, there are any number of books and there yeah. are tons and tons and tons. There's so many books, but then there are also like things that I think are maybe like implicit tools. So, you know, one thing that I think about are like, you know, yes, you can learn about like exclusively or explicitly about trauma, the effects of trauma. How does that, you know, both like physiologically and emotionally and psychologically like impact us? Like, yes, you can, you know, some people might want to like, I want to better understand the brain and how this all manifests. Mm. But then there are other things that I think are just as valuable, if not sometimes more valuable. And so something that I've been reading, because I consume a lot of like trauma knowledge and trauma like education. And sometimes I just need to like, I need to just put it down. It's yeah. like, I don't want to hear the word. I don't want to like, okay, it's now it's time to watch Legally Blonde for the 5,000th time, you know? And so, so I'm thinking of some of the other things that are, that I think could be and might be helpful. So one thing that I've been reading and I've been loving this book as both a parent, as a caregiver, as someone who's Gen X. And I feel like Gen Xers are yeah. probably quietly struggling with reparenting themselves like many yeah. times. But also thinking about like, as I'm listening to this book, and it's called Good Inside, and it's by Dr. Becky Kennedy, and it says, A Guide to Becoming the Parent You Want to Be. Mm-hmm. I feel like this book could and should be read by designers. It should be read by anyone who is a leader in an organization, because okay. it's very indicative to me of like how we formed attachment, how all of us formed attachment or were not able to form attachment when we were little, really does set, it sets a stage.
Yes.
And that stage can change. You know, there could be different props on that stage over time, but it does set a stage with how we might show up both for ourselves, but also like with others, like in this world. And so there's a lot that I feel like is really like giving me some curiosities again yes. about design and like, huh, like where am I seeing this show up? Where have I seen this show up? Where have I like exhibited some of these, I would say less than ideal like traits, like in both the workplace, but also maybe in my parenting and just in my own like interactions and interpersonal, you know, interactions. Another thing that I really like, you know, and I was part of this project, so I am a bit biased when I like suggest it, but this model of care for co-design. So this is work from K.A. McCurcher.
Yes.
K.A., you know, wrote a book called Beyond Sticky Notes, came out in, when did that come out? I think it was 2020 maybe. And it's such a good practical, there's no judgment, there's no shame. It's like giving designers, and I think just people who are just gatherers of practicing in that kind of a way, just some of the language and the tools and the possibilities of how you might care for people. Yes, you know, you
have it. And I love Before the Table of Content, there's a short paragraph says, I live in Australia on stolen Aboriginal lands and pay my respect to elders past, present, and emerging. I see the cause that has come with the sharing of this land, and I'm committed to justice and equity in my practice. If I don't get that right or could do more, please tell me. Mm-hmm. And to me, that sentence is the mindset we should adopt.
Yeah, that is K.A. exhibiting this practice of accountability,
yeah.
of like, help me become a better practitioner.
Yeah.
Call me out, call me in. Like, let's be in conversation about the ways in which we can continue to practice in other ways. And again, like this element of like pushing practice is really, I think, is just such a big component of it. But K.A. had this, so K.A. had the book and then had a model of care for co-design card deck that is, you know, is separate from the book, but is very complementary to the book. And then K.A. asked a group of us to help them come up with some additional cards for like an expansion pack. And so there's this great set. And so there are a couple that I contributed to this. Like there's one that just pulled here. It says, consider language carefully. And so I talk about the power of language. Like, mm-hmm. you know, the language that we use is really, really powerful, and it matters to both us and to other people around us. But the cards in this are just so, they're so thoughtful. They are, and they're so relevant to any kind of an experience. I don't think you need to be a designer to really appreciate some of these. Like, I'll share just one other one because I could probably sit here. We could do a whole podcast and I'll just read every single card. But there's one here from a friend and colleague, Lucy Flores, that says, like, offer nourishment. And it says, co-design can be an energy-intensive process. Food, hydration, opportunities for movement, and breaks help nourish co-designers. And so just like thinking about like sometimes this play on words is like, what does it mean to offer nourishment? What does it mean to nourish ourselves and nurture ourselves as part of these processes? So I feel like there are these, like, again, there are these explicit things that we can learn about trauma and trauma-informed care practices. And there are these implicit things that I feel like are so naturally like intersecting and intertwined with trauma responsive practices. Like this expansion pack on the model of care for co-design is like so clearly one of those examples. This book about reading about like how we all grow up and how maybe we've had different experiences and how the experiences that we had when we were little like really shape the experiences and the interactions that we have now. Again, that's part of this body of work that's around being trauma responsive.
Whether you're a teacher, maybe you're a nurse, maybe you're a team leader, but this will be relevant to just, I think, become a maybe more aware human being and perhaps an opportunity to give yourself some kindness if you realize that, whoopsie, you know, perhaps I reacted because I didn't have an attachment early on. It's not your fault. I mean, But to have that, then you can also, I would say, translate other people's behavior through this filter instead of judgment of like, all right, there might be something going on. So I think it just participates to making a kinder world, a more understanding world as well.
100%. How can we continue to deepen our understanding of both ourselves and others?
Yeah.
As we're doing anything that we might be doing, but, you know, especially in design, design is such an influential and powerful like tool in co-creating any number of things like with other people. It just feels inherently responsible to always be deepening that understanding.
And thank you, because that's what you provided us. Thank you so much, Rachel.
This has been really
precious.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us today. I hope you've been able to identify how you can integrate innovation and creativity in your daily life. If you would like to dive in or know more, you can contact me on my website, enoughcrea.com. Special thanks to Millimétrique, who composed my music themes. Thank you for listening, and bye for now.